It is my honor to introduce Joe Stiglitz. So here's the worst part of the biography. Joe became a full professor of economics at Yale at 27. You have no idea how much that hurts. He's taught at Princeton, Stanford, MIT, All Souls at Oxford. That one surprised me. He is now university professor at Columbia University, where university professor in the tradition of great research universities means you don't have to teach because we don't value that. Joe teaches because he's an Amherst product. So I've gotten used to introducing Joe as a Nobel Prize winner in 2001 in economics, but I see from this that he was the lead author of the 1995 report of Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. So we have a two-time Nobel laureate here. I think Linus Pauling is the only other one, and he was very weird. So Joe was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors to the President from 1993 to 95. He was the chairman of the council from 95 to 97. He was the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank from 1997 to 2000. He is the author of more books than you can shake a stick at. Globalization and Its Discontents, I recommend to you. Making Globalization Work. There are another 12 or 20 beyond that. The $3 trillion war about Iraq. And just this week, as you have no doubt read in the national press, Joe has published Free Fall. There's a cheery title, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. I welcome Joe Stiglitz, and I welcome you all to buy this serious and seriously depressing book, Professor Stiglitz.
As Tony said, there's a little dismal tone in the book, but obviously you don't want to be too dismal because people don't want to buy books that are too dismal. But the fact of the matter is that economics is called the dismal science, and the last couple of years have been a field day for The Economist. One of the things the trustees have been struggling with, like most American families, of how to manage the fallout of this crisis, the budgetary consequences. And that's what we've been spending the last few days and actually the last year or more. Well, this is a global crisis. The U.S. Exported the crisis around the world, probably not our most proud export. The global crisis has a clear Made in USA label on it. I joke about sending a thank you note to Europe because they bought about 40% of our toxic mortgages. So if they hadn't bought so many of our toxic mortgages and the kind of economic philosophy that said that they ought to buy those toxic mortgages, the downturn in the United States could have been much worse. So as bad as things are, you could imagine they could have been worse, if that makes you cheerful. The fact that it's a global crisis does have one important implication. When there was a global financial crisis little over a decade ago in Korea, Indonesia, those countries rebounded quickly because they could export to the United States and to Europe. They were small countries and there was a global market. But because this crisis is as bad in Europe as it is in the United States, it's very difficult for us or Europe to export our way out of the crisis. You know, again, I jokingly say trade with Mars is sufficiently small that not everybody can export their way out of this crisis. The one part of the world that is doing well and has had a strong rebound is Asia. And it's interesting because the reason that they're in part doing so well is that they took our courses seriously. We teach standard macroeconomic courses about when you have an economic downturn, you're supposed to use counter-cyclical policies, stimulate the economy with monetary and fiscal policy. Some of you may remember those courses with great pain. Well, there was a reason for studying that, and they did study it in China. Now, my book is one of the best-selling books there. And they take it seriously, and they had a much bigger stimulus than the United States. And I'll come back to that if I have time. I've been under strict time constraints by my boss. So, but the fact is their stimulus relative to the size of the economy was much, much larger than the United States, and their rebound has been amazing. Their growth this year is almost 9%, less than 12 or 13% that it had been before, but still not bad. And right now they're worrying about getting an overheated economy. There's a great deal of debate, and that's one of the main things, one of the things I do in the book, about the causes of the crisis and the nature of the problem. The reason I spend time devoted to that, because if you don't understand what caused the crisis, you're not going to be able to fix it, and you're certainly not going to be able to prevent a recurrence, which is why it's important to understand what gave rise to it. And there are several views captured by a couple metaphors. One of them that a lot of people tried to push in the beginning, at least. Well, there's a little bit of a problem. The plumbing is clogged. And when the plumbing is clogged, who do you call? The same plumber who put in the bad pipes in the first place, because he's the only one who knows where the problems in the plumbing are. And you know that they're going to overcharge you for fixing, and you know that you're going to have another problem later on. But this is a case where the pipes are clogged, but the problems are much more serious, and we need to do something about it. Another metaphor that's sometimes used is, particularly by people in the financial market, is this is a once in a 100-year flood. How could we have prepared for it? You know, these are things, stuff happens, as sometimes says. But this is not something that happened to the financial markets. This is something the financial markets created. It was man-made, and that is an important point, and a really very important point in the policy discourse, to realize that it was man-made, and therefore we have to do something to prevent a recurrence of what happened. In my view, very simple: the banks engaged in excessive risk-taking, they mismanaged risk, and they misallocated capital. In a sense, they didn't fulfill their basic societal functions, which are managing risk, allocating capital, managing a payments mechanism, and doing it all at a low transaction cost. They did none of this, and yet they charged a high transaction cost. 40% of all corporate profits in the years before the crisis went to finance. And that really illustrates a fundamental problem. They forgot, and we forgot, that finance is a means to an end, not an end in itself. When finance works well, our society functions well. It's absolutely essential. So when I say it's a very important means, so I don't want to denigrate it. But if it doesn't work well, the economy, society doesn't function. But it's not an end in itself. And that is, as I say, an important lesson. In writing the book, one of the critical issues is each time you give an answer, you have to ask another question. And really, and this is part of the Amherst tradition of keep asking questions. And I have to say, for all of you, that Amherst really did have an enormous influence on my intellectual development, and one of the reasons why I was so enthusiastic to serve as a trustee. So you ask the question, you know, why didn't it do what it was supposed to do? And the obvious answer to that question is, both at the individual level and at the organizational level, there were distorted incentives. The market economy only works when private rewards are aligned with social returns. And you look at the incentive structures at the individual level, they had incentives to undertake excessive risk-taking and short-sighted behavior. Organizational incentives, you had a lot of organizations that had become too big to fail. This was a very dramatic change over the last 10 years that no one had really focused on. And when you're too big to fail, what does that mean? It means every time you take a risk, you have a one-sided bet. If you win, you walk off with the profits. If you lose, the taxpayer picks up the tab. And that's what happens. And with those kind of incentives, what do you expect to happen? You take more risk. I mean, in a way, before the crisis, as a professor of economics, I was in an embarrassing situation. Because the one thing that economists agree on is that incentives matter. But if incentives mattered, we ought to have had a problem before, as I was lecturing to my students, in 2004, 5, 6, and 7, I kept predicting that there was going to be a problem. Because these incentives should lead to bad behavior. And I thought they were. But the manifestation was not apparent. So from an academic point of view, the crisis is a relief. It shows... It shows that our theories were right. And I don't have to rewrite my textbook. I can go on. But it does cause a lot of pain for a lot of other people. Now, as I say, you have to keep pushing back the question. The incentive systems were wrong. And the next question is, why did they have the wrong incentive systems? Isn't capitalism, one of the advantages of capitalism, to design incentive systems to do the right thing? Well, to get the answer to that and a lot of other questions, you're going to have to buy the book. So going forward, one of the things I think we need at this juncture is a focus on stakes and localities. Stakes and localities have a balanced budget framework. If tax revenues are plummeting, they're down across the country about more than $200 billion, and that means... layoffs, furloughs, particularly makes no sense when people are unemployed or young people. One of the things they like to do is go to school to get their skills up. At least when the economy recovers, they'll have more and more skills. But the problem is that there are cutbacks in community colleges and universities all over the country. So that is one of the priorities I would have. On the mortgages, again, we finally did something. The fact that we weren't doing something to me was sort of like when we were giving money to the banks, it was like a mass blood transfusion to a patient suffering from internal hemorrhaging and doing nothing about the internal bleeding, which was the mortgage market. We finally did something, but again, as I said, we didn't address the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem was that the boom... The bubble, which had sustained the economy before the crisis, had burst. Now, there are some people, in a way, part of the debate that was going on was, what was reality? There was one view that the high prices were reality, and we were just in a temporary nightmare from which we would wake up and the prices would go up again. The other view was that this bubble was a dream, was not sustainable, and that which is not sustainable won't be sustained. Prices came down, and the reality was the low prices. I think the evidence is overwhelming that the second view is correct, but what is the implication? The implication is that the reality is that now about a quarter of all Americans owe more on their home than the value of their house. Negative equity. So we didn't do anything about that problem of negative equity. Well, the third thing, we poured money into the banks, but we didn't link the money to lending. Let me put it in another way. When we reformed welfare program in 1996, we put all kinds of conditions on those who were receiving welfare. They had to go to training programs, they had to look for work. But when we put the banks on welfare, which we did, we didn't put any conditions. And the same incentives that led them to the original problem were still prevailing without any constraints. Not surprisingly, we didn't get the result that we wanted. Finally, in the last couple weeks, there has been a move to try to change the regulatory structure, move it in a way to address some of the problems that I talked about before, some of the incentive problems, some of the excessive risk-taking. I don't think it's enough, but it's far more than what had been done in the previous year, and it is clearly, in my judgment, a move in the right direction. Let me just conclude with three very brief remarks. First, one of the reasons that we're having a problem right now is that I think there's a real need for a vision of where our economy is going to go and a vision of where, for instance, our financial sector. And when we put money into the financial sector, we didn't have a clear vision of what kind of financial sector we wanted. For instance, part of our financial sector is doing a very good job. Venture capital firms, some banks lend to small and medium-sized businesses, which are a part of job creation. But when we were pouring money in to the banks, we didn't have a vision of what parts of the financial system are doing the things they're supposed to and what parts are not. And it's a broader issue in the transformation of our economy. We're going through a transformation from a manufacturing economy to a new economy that's quite different. We needed a vision of how to facilitate that transformation, and that didn't occur. The second point is the crisis detracted us from a large number of longstanding problems, some problems new, demographic problem, problem of climate change, the problem of the transition from manufacturing to a knowledge economy, to a service sector economy, a whole list of those that I talk about. The problem is not only is the crisis distracting us from these long-run problems, because of the way the crisis was managed, our national deficit has soared. Our national debt has soared. And that means we have less resources to deal with these problems. And the increase of our national debt has really been huge. It was $5.7 trillion when President Bush became the president. When he left the presidency, it was around $11 trillion. It's expected to be another $10 trillion larger in the next 10 years. So this is a serious problem of concern. The final issue I want to raise is it is quite obvious that the financial sector misallocated one of our scarce resources, capital. Our financial resources. If all that money had been invested in new enterprises that would lead to an increase in productivity, new technology, making our economy greener to address the problems of global climate change, we would have increased our productivity. We've been better ready for the 21st century. But I think the real loss is something else, and it was something that came out very forcefully in the hearings that I was in yesterday on the Hill, and that is there is a concern about the misallocation of human capital of our brightest students, and in a way that really leads into the link between what Amherst is trying to do. The question is we're trying to create the campaign is about lives of consequence. There are many different ways in which people can live lives of consequence, and when the Amherst education is really training people for providing them the tools, the resources to have those lives of consequences. And the worry is that to a large extent, some of our most precious asset, our most talented people, were diverted into one part of our economy, into financial sector. We need talented people there. The question is balance. And just like we lost the balance between the market and the state, we lost the balance between the financial sector and the rest of the economy. The big lesson now is to try to learn that lesson, and going forward to try to create a more balanced economy, and I think also a more balanced society. Thank you.